Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Ryan.
How are you doing today?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm excited. We have a big thing to discuss today on our podcast, but I'm even more excited that the Yumlings have all gathered around to hear us talk about it. Thank you so much, people, for tuning in. We call you Yumlings because we're the Yum Yum Podcast, the only Australian Babylon 5 podcast, even in hell. I checked down there. I went to hell, checked down there, and there's no Australian Babylon 5 podcast. There is an Australian Crusade podcast down there, which makes sense because, boy oh boy, is that show hellish. But no Australian Babylon 5 podcasts exist in hell or in our average day-to-day life. I have searched the galaxy. The multiverse is now hell. Next week, I'm going to heaven to check if there's any up there. But we are the only ones that have the market cornered on that. And we are rewatching Babylon 5. We're reviewing it episode by episode, talking about what it's like to come back to it. Look at an episode again. Look at one that you saw in the past and thought, that was an interesting piece of business, but how interesting would it be if I looked at it again and talked about it on a podcast? Now, Rachel, Yum Yum.
Yes.
Is a line of dialogue that you love so much. Could you please explain it to everyone who needs to know, which is all of them? All of the people downloaded or streaming this episode need to know.
Where did
Yum Yum come from?
From a show. They know.
Who are they?
I don't need to tell them again.
Please explain please. I've done so much work. I went to hell and I managed to come back. Could you please tell us all where Yum Yum is from?
Well, I've been to hell and back and it's called watching Star Trek Discovery. And that's where that line's from. Unfortunately, Ryan loved that moment so much where a individual being paid to act was told to say yum yum, and then they did, and our lives changed forever.
You know, the Academy, they know that Michelle Yeoh's in that show, and they still gave her the award anyway. Just so you know, Michelle Yeoh's in that scene, and she initiates the yum yum line to happen. Many, many, many years ago, she said to this character, "Hey, you wanna help me kill a guy?" And this other character, not played by Michelle Yeoh, but a potential future Oscar winner, because that's the thing. This scene contains one. What's stopping the other person, the yum yum deliverer, from getting the award? Nothing's stopping them. But let's just talk about the episode of B5 we are looking at today. Now, we are up to a pretty monumental one. It is the title of Season 4. Each season of B5 has a title that is also an episode of the show. And each one of them is usually a banger, usually a game changer, usually one that is worthy of all the hype and praise. So what are we talking about today, Rachel?
No surrender, no retreat.
We are watching this on the DVDs. We have the physical media, which means that we get to have descriptions that only exist on the DVDs. And what does it have to say for No Surrender, No Retreats?
Unwilling to endure Earth Force attacks on civilians, Sheridan sends his fleet to confront the Earth starships that illegally encircle Proxima 3. His demand to the starship commanders, stand down or die.
You're in violation of the Proxima Treaty, and your attacks on civilian transports are illegal under the rules of engagement and the Articles of War. You can leave peacefully if that is your choice,
but we are prepared to use deadly force if necessary.
I think of No Surrender, No Retreat as not an individual episode, but just a piece of the arc overall. So when I think back to it, it's not one that has always individually leapt out, but it as a general general piece of B5's lore has always jumped out to me. Like B5, we all talk about the Shadows and the Vorlons and the Centauri and all that, but the Earth conflict has always been there, and it's a major component of the series. And so this definitely has a high pedigree to it when it comes to that.
Yeah, I always kind of feel like if smushing together the Earth arcs, including this episode, would kind of make for a better TV movie than most of the ones that we got.
Oh, Rachel, wait till you watch In the Beginning, which is all Earth military stuff. Just you wait.
Yeah, I'm not talking about that, though. I'm talking about the episodes that we do get in this arc, which is very different. And
But Jakar even references the Earth Minbari War in this episode in a way that we can now have him in the TV movie in scenes that are true to what he said in this episode. Jakar was here, but would you say that he had YYE, yum, yum, energy?
Yes.
A person that could have said yum, yum in this given episode if they had the opportunity, if JMS wasn't a coward.
Yeah, of course he brings YYE. What are you talking about?
But is he the person with the, is he the YYE candidate of the episode?
Not mine. Like, he's a contender, definitely. Always is. Always will be. Nothing is yum yum quite like saying good eating to you. So
great line.
Just gonna remind you that. I'm gonna go for a random one. Was a nameless character who just like had a little spark to them.
Okay.
And I want you to guess.
Was it one of the Earth Force people?
No.
No, it wasn't. Was it a ranger?
No.
A Minbari?
No.
Oh, we're running out of people. Was it one of the council aliens?
No.
I don't know. You've got me. You're going to say something so ludicrous. You've gone to concepts more recently. Like, you were like, moments of transition. I'm going to pick the crowd in the auditorium and... because they're there wiggling their arms. I'm like, that's a real concept you're picking there. No, what are you proposing?
The security officer who's checking Garibaldi's ID.
Oh, okay. I'm going to go with Captain Hall, who is, of course, Ken Jenkins.
Yes.
He was itching to say it. I could see it in his eyes, but...
He's just too obvious.
My second one, a guy who also doesn't have lines, is Mackie's second, Bob, who points
really
the gun.
Wants the promotion.
He really wants that promotion. That's a guy, if he had one line of dialogue, it would be yum yum. That's the line.
I always knew you wanted a promotion, Bob. Never knew how badly until now.
You spoke his name, and now we must talk about the devil, Garibaldi. We'll pick away at some of the smaller aspects and then get to the big stuff. Garibaldi's in, what, two scenes in this episode? Maybe three? He's here to talk to Londo initially, but Londo isn't here, so he gets to talk to Veer, and Veer reveals that Sheridan is making a direct campaign against Earth and is taking back the colonies and then Earth itself, and Garibaldi is very distressed by this. He is very unsettled and pissed off about this. And there's the thrust of the conversation is him saying that he is all about taking back Earth, taking down the Clark government and regime, but he doesn't respect the way and appreciate or agree with how Sheridan is doing it, and that he is going to fight back for his people in his own way. And we don't necessarily know what that means, but we know that just from the tone of things and Veer's reaction, that this isn't a good thing. You want Garibaldi to see the merit in what Sheridan is doing because there's a clear line in the sand.
Because we
do. Yes, because there's a clear line in the sand that has been crossed by Earth, and it's time to punch him in the face and give him a black eye.
We can't walk back. We can't walk it back. We can't turn away from this fight because they're attacking the defenseless now.
Garibaldi is supposed to be about defending those people. He's had whole conversations about changing their lives and seeing their face and helping those who can't help themselves. And here Sheridan is doing that, but Garibaldi has problems with it. And what do you think about Garibaldi in this episode? Because he's only here for a small bit, but it is such a seminal moment for him that he decides to leave the station over this. So what are your thoughts overall?
I am still angry at him. I am just annoyed by Garibaldi so much at this point in the season. And he's running off to Mars, into the arms of that fuckwit Edgars. And he's playing into what they want him to be. Them being the cycle.
And Bestia specifically.
But it all makes sense. It makes sense, especially like knowing what we know and having been on this journey many a time. But he still pisses me off.
Yeah. Looking at it just from the ground level of what we've been experiencing with Garibaldi episode by episode right to this point, it's a logical progression of the story. But it definitely is still framed in a way where you are not sympathetic to Garibaldi. We've gone past that point of his story because at the beginning, it does play with that. It wants you to see things from his point of view. It wants you to see that there's a grain of truth in what he's spewing, even if he's doing it in a very volatile and hostile way. When he was complaining about Lorien, there was a point there that you could nod along going, yes, I totally see where you're coming from.
There's always a grain or a seed that it sprouts from.
But we're past that now. And the series is definitely leaning into making him an unsympathetic character, but still shrouding it in intrigue. So you want to follow him and see where this all leads to. Now, we know where it leads to. And so a moment like this has a different feel to it when you're revisiting it. And I've been enjoying, as have you to an extent, looking at Garibaldi being an absolute piss baby in season 4. And I actually really enjoyed this back and forth between Veer and him, where we get an insight into how Veer works and the obvious differences between Veer and Garibaldi. Two characters you never think to compare each other against, but both of them are, to an extent, the right-hand man of power. Yes, like Garibaldi is the right-hand man to the captain or the commander, and Veer is the right hand to Londo. And Veer talks about how even though he disagrees very heavily with Londo and he doesn't appreciate his choices, every once in a while Londo's right and Londo is correct. And so Veer has to, and he says this like it's his penance, he's like his job to give him the benefit of the doubt. And Garibaldi rejects that notion. Yeah. He says, I'm not doing that. No. That's not right. And here's the tricky thing. I think that's where the grain of truth comes in when it comes to Garibaldi in this episode, because when Veer says that, I'm disappointed in Veer, honestly.
It's just like, no, you're enabling a war criminal.
Yeah, and it is.
We know what Londo's done. He may be remorseful, but that doesn't mean that he is not accountable for his actions.
He is the reason you are having nightmares about the actions you were forced to take because of the choices he made and choices that you helped enable in the first place. So when Garibaldi says, fuck that, I'm not about that, I reject that, I'm going to stand on my own two feet and follow through on what I believe, it makes complete sense because that's what his character really has been in season four. And so having this awkward but also polite and hostile conversation between two characters who are on extremely different ends of the spectrum when it comes to loyalty or following someone that you don't agree with, it was actually really fascinating to see that on this watch because I've never really paid attention to this scene in this particular way. I've always noted it as, oh, this is how Garibaldi gets information. Oh, Veer is still having troubles about having killed a person. But all of that is great as well. But just looking at the heart of the conversation right there, the disagreement, the fundamental opposition, these two characters who we rarely see interact ever.
Yeah, which is odd because they do match up with each other in those ways that you outlined before. But we get the more sort of direct comparative thing of Lanier and Veer more often. And that's still only very occasionally, but for us, we enjoy those moments so much. They stick out really clearly.
I don't always like the way Londo does things, and, well, me in most civilized worlds, but, you know, sometimes he's right. So I force myself to give him the benefit of the doubt.
I can't do that anymore.
So you're not going to fight for your world?
Of course I'm going to fight. I'm going to fight in my own way.
Two characters that have been joined at the hip since the very beginning of the show is Londo and Jakar. And I only wrote one note during the big scene that they had, which was, this is the best scene.
The drink at the bar?
No, the trying to have a drink in Jakar's quarters.
Yeah, but... That is the better part, but it wouldn't be as heartwarming. But because of how the episode ends and where I know that it's going, it has a heartwarming element.
Because they'll be best friends.
Yeah, when Londo's just like, we'll never be friends. Oh. And I'm like, you will.
You will.
And you'll be total cuties and then you'll strangle each other to death. And it's
but
just,
as friends. But as friends.
Just, it gets the ultimate release because you're both in such pain. And oh my God. And it's the benefit of both of your world. And
I'm just going to say it. I'm just going to say it.
I'm so sad and so happy at the same time, just thinking about it.
I'm just going to say it. We've had some amazing ones before, and we'll have some amazing ones to come.
Yes.
But I think this is the best scene between Jakar and Londo. The one where he enters his quarters and they just break it down. Their relationship, what everything has led to this moment and how this impasse exists for a reason. Because you're mad at both of them during the scene, upset with both of them, and hoping for the best for both of them.
That pattern.
Mm-hmm. And they're both justified. You understand where both of them are at. And to me, it's the best acted scene between them. But if you had to grab me by the shoulders and say, Ryan, what is a scene that encapsulates the Jakar and Londo relationship? It's this scene.
Yeah.
It's this scene right here.
Yeah. I have to agree with you, but I think for me, the elevator scene nudges it out just a little bit.
Oh, where they're trapped?
Where they're trapped, and he's just like, I have to do nothing, and I get to watch you die.
That's a fun one. That is a fun. So let's talk about the actual content of the Jakar and Londo story here, because it's only two scenes as well. It's very short.
Yes.
Sheridan needs the support of all of the other worlds, and he needs them to let Earth go, to break off their treaties and their diplomatic relations with them and let
Earth stand alone. Have non-aggression things, but like just help us out a little bit and ignore Ignore them. But yes, humanitarian aid. Yes, do that. Please, please get involved if it means that, if it means helping people.
And Londo is very swayed by this. And so he makes a meeting with Jakar to talk to him and to propose that they sign a joint statement backing Sheridan and his cause. And that will in turn hopefully sway all of the other powerful races, all of the others out there, to fall in line with this as well. So if two people who were at war, almost annihilated each other within the last year, can agree on one really thing in particular, then that means everything. And that's Londo's, that's his plan. That's what he decides. And he thinks that he can persuade Jakar to do this because Jakar's gone through all of these things that have made him this enlightened being, but he also really is there to almost wash his hands of a lot of the accountability that he has, because he now, Londo,
this,
but also Londo
then
is,
it kind of makes up for those other things. Like, Londo very much still has that idea of he can balance the scales.
Right. And he thinks that if I now take accountability for my, like, for me, like everything's through the prism of me, then it's fine. It's better. It's better than it was. And that means it's good now, right? Just because I am now aware of how harmful my choices have been, that means you should in turn forgive me as well. And that's not how it works. So a large friction in the scene is the fact that Londo is so overcome with good intentions that he thinks that washes away all of the past and the current that these two have between them.
And even though they were both like, we're just going to stay out of each other's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And Londo's breaking that treaty.
Yeah, he is knocking at his door. He's pressing the button, and Jakar knows it's him. You know it's an excellent scene when Jakar is stiff, sitting down, and he just is playing with whoever is at that door. We know it's Londo, so does he. The doorbell rings, 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 and he just lets it go for a bit and then opens it up. Toying with Londo before we even start the scene.
Establishing
proper.
His control over the situation before it even fully begins, which is a very classic Jakar move. He likes to know everything that's on the table and how he's going to play it out before he is even in the position to start with. Like, that's the degree of control that Jakar classically wants. He wants all of the cards on the table to be known by him and for him to be the one dealing it out, because he's used to being in a position of power and control and for information to be the most powerful tool in any battle that he goes into.
He has some pride still within him, and that maintains through the end of the episode, where, yes, he will do the right thing, but for the matter of himself and his pride, and just for the sake of being vindictive, I won't sign it on the same page. You know, you understand that, right? Yes, of course. And so, because all of those things you just mentioned, he had to strip away, he had to relinquish, he had to let go of, he had to let them be whipped out of him for the sake of Londo and for the sake of his own people. And so here he is in a moment where that's not necessary. And he, in this sequence, gives in to that attitude of, I don't have to do that. That's not owed. I'm not having to do that. But by the end of the episode, he knows better and he does agree and he does sign the thing, but he like, still has this little fuck you in
he
there.
He remembered the little kosh message that he got.
Yes. But what a powerful scene. Basically, every line, every piece of direction, every piece of acting is a 10 out of 10. Everything can be analyzed within this so much. Every piece of back and forth with, oh, the chains aren't on the wall, the cleaning must have taken them, must be up so upsetting, and how Londo wants to just argue back and they spur at each other.
He wants to bite.
Yes.
And Jakari's baiting him.
Right. And they fall back into those familiar patterns. How easy it is. And just that sentiment right there is such a just moving one, because you can apply that to the real world, whether it's you on a personal level or you can expand it out to different cultures, different countries, different moments in time. And I just think, and obviously you can reflect that into the show itself about how often we see characters unable to patch up their differences because they are stuck in a routine, in a pattern, in a history with one another, that it takes a whole series, like whole five seasons worth of development to get past.
That's definitely totally unrelated to the Garibaldi conversation we were just having.
Oh yeah, Garibaldi is going through a similar thing himself. Yes.
No.
Isn't it amazing how quickly we fall into familiar patterns as soon as we come into one another's orbit? Like comets that flare when they get too near the sun. I did not come here to spar with you, Jakar.
Londo isn't there yet, being like a good person, because he is an asshole during this scene. He's an imperialist. He's a piece of shit. He's selfish, self-serving, but he's also all of these other positive attributes as well that makes it conflicting when you watch him in the show, where you almost want to be, oh, yay, Londo, you're doing the right noble thing. You're a good guy again. I can feel justified for liking you now because you're on the good path. But Jakar points it out throughout the scene that your sorry means nothing. Like, your apology, he doesn't even say sorry, by the way. Just, that's an important thing to note. Like, you admiring me means less than your thanks. You coming here is an insult to me. You pointing out all of the traumas that's happened to you within the last year is completely innocuous in comparison to the things that I've had to go through, things that you put me through, you specifically. I know that you started this all. This is your fault. Leave me alone. And, I mean, how do you feel about just that in general, though? When it comes to Londo, we've talked about, like, his intentions in the scene, what he's wanting to do, but on that level of, just as a viewer, you're wanting to, I imagine, be at a place where you feel okay liking a character that has done such horrible things.
Yeah, but yes and no, I guess, is my semi-answer to that. Because, yeah, I do want to feel okay liking Londo, but Londo lives and breathes and is just such a showcase of a character in the gray. So I never feel great about liking him, even on a rewatch, but I never feel guilty for liking him either, because when he's at his worst, I'm still afraid for him. I still care for him. I still want to see the good in him and see that come back out again later. Because it is this cycle that you go through with him across the five seasons.
And this exists because we knew what he was like. we rooted for him, we cared for him, and we've seen him become this bad person. Something that was always within him, but we saw it come out.
He was always a bad person. He just got the opportunity to make really powerful bad decisions.
And then it's on the flip side. He was always also a good person, and he always had the opportunities to do good things, and he didn't always do them. And he forgot that he could do them, and that's him here. He admits to that, that he is a patriot. He's trying to do this all for the sake of his people, but in the end, he was the enemy. He was the person that almost destroyed not just one society, but two in the whole entire thing. Like, he almost destroyed two planets. And he's saying, well, if I was the enemy at one time, like, how can I trust my own abilities when I thought I was doing the right thing, when I thought I was being a good person? And I just bring this up because when I say guilty, like, I mean in the sense of, at least for my viewership, of, like, when I watch it, I know that he's bad and he's done all of these things, and I feel guilty in the sense of liking him, because it's more about, is the series justifying making this a character that I should still feel some warm feelings towards and even dare root to become a good person and save the day? We talked about this heavily with Star Trek Discovery, where one of the main characters, the Michelle Yeoh character, Empress Georgiou, was also a mass murderer, genocidal fascist, and they gave her a redemption arc, and they ended her story, and everyone cheered to her memory and said she was great. And it was very distressing that they were doing that, because she was a fascist, she was all of these horrible things. And we could say the same about Londo, like, he's all these horrible things, but I'm not really that distressed about the series playing around with his morality, his soul, his regrets, and potential redemption, because we've built up to it. We've built up to it. We knew what he was like before. We had it before. And the thing is, the series, as well as the characters within it, like Jakar in this, is keeping him accountable for what he is. It's never forgetting what he has done and why he has done it. And so when he has that moment here of actual acknowledgement of how fucked up he has been, it's a sigh of relief for me, the viewer, because finally we're getting into the part of the show where he is acknowledging the fact that he has ruined so much for everyone around him. It's like in Breaking Bad, when you get to a certain point where it's just clear that it's about Walter White's ego, but he's refusing to admit that. And so when he finally admits that it was for him, you take a sigh of relief and go, fucking finally.
It's just like, oh my God, I understand. But how? Like, you've done so much to stop yourself from seeing that truth.
Londo calls back to a moment where peace could have been a thing, the drink at the bar. He tries to offer this moment again as an olive branch. And I think it's on point very much for a character who has a nostalgic rose-tinted look of the past and is always trying to chase to the good old days when things were great or things were on the precipice of greatness, that even here when he's trying to step away from that kind of behavior, he still falls into it by trying to make a moment of what could have been greatness happen again. And Jakar refuses it. He pours it back into the bottle and just sits there and goes back to writing until Londo leaves. I think that was another just... It's tricky because the scene at the bar was arguably one of the best scenes in The Coming of Shadows, right? That's like one of the greats. And it's always like a dangerous thing to have a callback and a little almost recreation of one of the greatest scenes you've put in the show already. But they do it here, and it's pulled off because it isn't the same, and it isn't so overtly winking and so fucking proud of itself that it's calling back to that moment. And the context is different as well.
Because while I do not know who the enemy is any longer, I do know who my friends are. And that I have not done as well by them as I should. I hope to change that. I hope to do better.
No Surrender, No Retreat is a very hectic episode. The pacing is unstoppable. It is just plowing forward. We have a lot lots of visuals happening. As mentioned, Michael Vejar is really going full force with his direction here, and the cinematography is just in full swing. So when we have a scene like this, it stands out all the more because it's just two characters talking, and all of that flash, all of that panache that makes the prepping for war or the battle sequences themselves or you surrender, no, you surrender stuff dramatically enriching to watch, all of that stuff is put to the side for a scene of two people who have a real history together to confront each other. It just makes it memorable. Like, this is one of the scenes I remember the most when it comes to these two. And it's because of the visuals as well, of just Jakar sitting there.
Yeah.
With his quill, writing, and the amount of times he stops, and the insert shots of Jakar's bemused or pissed off face, and Londo, he's walking all over the quarters. He's making positions here, here, and here. It's a very well choreographed scene. It's a Babylon 5 has a staginess to it, but this is one where you could definitely see this in a play, but they still remember that this is a television show, so you have some shots that are just perfectly placed in there. Talking about the visuals, just to skip to that note, I did write down that we should talk about the visuals. I've already mentioned that it has a very frantic but fluid nature to it. And I just want to hear from you. What did you think about that? Because No Surrender, No Retreat is a pretty big, beefy episode, but a lot of the things I remember isn't the story or the action or the beats being told through the dialogue or even character moments, but through just the direction alone. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I thought that it was stunning. I noticed from sort of the very first scene, and particularly through the scenes that happen before the credits, it's so fluid. The camera is in this state of flow, and it's not just the onset decisions, but also the editing that really helps. So there's this sense of kinetic energy that the cinematography brings.
We talk so much about the writing. Oh, JMS did this, JMS wrote that. But you need the production and your directors to bring that to life. And I mean this sincerely, but I've just watched No Surrender, No Retreat, and I know that there's conversations in there between Sheridan and Ivanova, or there's moments of Marcus, or the back and forths over the radio between the captains and all of that, but that there is so minor to me.
I think of the shot of Marcus running down to the war room.
All of them getting called to the meeting, and V's hair's a mess.
Yeah. He's like fallen asleep on it. Smooth blocking of everybody on the bridges of each of the Earth ships.
Well, the many Corwin shots. Lots of Corwin shots in
We get some juicy Corwin down.
The way the camera whips around and follows Ivanova and Corwin during the scene where he's asking her who should they trust, and is it a trust no one situation? No, trust me, trust yourself, and blah. And then anyone you don't trust, shoot him. And how the camera has been so movement heavy, and then when that line is said, it pans right back to Corwin and some other guy reacting with a ho. Oh, boy, that's a lot. And that's it. It's just still again. I know that there's so many great like exchanges, because when people talk about B5, when we look back at B5, a lot of it always goes back to the wonderful writing and the wonderful performances, and remember that exchange here, and remember this story beat here, remember that thematic arc and all of that. But this, especially for one that's a title of a season, all of those things, as great as they are, is secondary to just how it was presented on the screen. I keep thinking of the shots of the ships and how they're exploding and dodging and weaving, and the Star Furies are flying right at the camera, and the mixing of CG and live action is done fairly well, and just many moments of creative blocking, like Marcus showing Sheridan on their little what would you call that, like their screens that they have, like the see-through screens, and we're not getting the traditional we're seeing it like from the other side, like we're seeing it from behind the screen because it's see-through, so we're being obstructed by it to see Marcus explaining it to Sheridan, who's way in the back, like that there is just something that has stuck. There's with me
lots of layers of meaning that you can unpack within the choices of the cinematography in this episode. Another thing that I want to note about the visuals, and I know we've said this before, but I think it really deserves to be highlighted again, is the CGI. Because a lot of this episode is a space battle. And it wouldn't work if that CGI didn't, like if it didn't feel real. And the thing that I kept on going back to is this feels like it has weight. Even now you get CG that doesn't feel like it has, the objects have gravity.
No, that's been a big complaint with Star Wars recently, with The Mandalorian, a series that was praised for its atmosphere and its tension and all of these beautiful effects. And now we've gone to this point where it looks like a cartoon. It looks so goofy and light and silly. And you go, oh, yeah, Star Wars, Ryan. But like at one point, that wasn't the case with that series in particular. I really like how Babylon 5's space, like the space they fight in, the space they fly through, is colorful. And in an episode like this where we're fighting Earth, we're having to take out people who've killed civilians, and we're having to possibly fight people who may be, you know, on the wrong side, but they could be still good people because they're still, it's all morally complex. I like the blood red orange and all of this, like, very vibrant color scheme, but it's vibrant not in the way of, like, hyper, like, stylized color, but vibrant in this really bleak fashion of, like, this is where the blood gets shed right here.
And I really like the way that they make each of the bridges that we do see visually distinct from each other. Because it's not just the set design, it's the layout, it's the lighting, it's the shot compositions and angles and sizes and all of that that go to create a very specific atmosphere. So it only takes like a couple of shots for you to go, okay, what? We're on this ship. You don't need to see the person that we're following on each of those bridges to know which bridge it is, which is so amazing.
For a series with a lower budget and minimal amounts of sets, they really know how to use them at this point. And really harping on those visuals, but the direction as well, I could watch this without the sound on. And I could tell you that Captain Hall is the asshole, Mackie is the good guy who's conflicted. Like, I could tell you that from their posture, their body language, their expressions. Mackie's uniform, I swear, and this could be lighting, but I wouldn't put it past B5. his blue of his uniform was a lighter, more vibrant blue than that of Captain Hull's uniform. They should be the exact same, but for some reason, I just looked at it and went, his is more friendly to look at than Captain Hull's, which had like a dark, like it just felt a bit darker, like a shade or two different.
See, I took it differently. I paired that with the little info drop that we got earlier in the war room when he says, oh, I don't know some of those names. They must be new. So I took it as Hull has that kind of uniform because he's newer to the position and newer because he's in Clark's pocket.
Yeah.
Rather than Mackie, who's
old school.
So he has like an older looking uniform.
Yeah, which means that it could be like a lighter faded. But
yeah, like I just made that up in my head for whatever reason.
But just to talk about it again, you could turn the sound off and just that choice alone, whether it's because of the practicality of what you said or it's matter of lighting or maybe it's just a costume mistake or maybe Mackie's costume is a newer one and that one for Captain Hull's an older one, like whatever the case may be, it still said to me, oh, that one's a good guy. That one's a bad guy.
Good guy. Bad guy. Trust him. Don't trust him.
This is so silly, but this is, I'm going to give away a bit of my spotlight conversation here because we're going to talk about Ken Jenkins, of course. But one of my favorite pieces of acting from Ken Jenkins, and this is in line with the conversation, is when he presses that button on his chair to communicate back. He's so cocky and confident.
Yeah.
And he presses it with this absolute assuredness. The way he did that still told me, this guy's a piece of shit. But the way Mackie did it, the way he would lean in and he would kind of lean forward and has this posture of like,
I'm open to this communication.
But he's leaning forward in a way that says, I'm here.
The bunny
I'm
language.
I'm talking.
Yeah.
Told me that this is guy with like, he's assured of himself, but he is like a proper person.
Confidence, not arrogance.
Back at the academy, you used to pose moral conflicts for us as part of our training. You said that soldiers aren't machines. They have to think. They have to decide if an order is moral or not.
But what does your conscience tell you?
What I think is really tricky about No Surrender, No Retreat when it comes to this, and I love the episode, but I just find it so... Sheridan is such a Boy Scout, even now when he's kicking their teeth in, because it's not like they kill any of the ships on purpose.
No.
It's accidental.
Or be it's destroyed.
Yeah.
It's just like,
That White Star crashed into it because it got shot and then it spun out of control. Like, it's still afraid to throw the mud and the blood and the dirt onto Sheridan, even though it's promising that it is. And I think that's just, I don't know, I find that just such a tricky ground to walk because you don't want your main character to be such an asshole. But at the same time, I do grit my teeth a little and pull my hair out a tad in this episode with how Boy Scouty and gentlemanly and he's phoning them up and telling them like, I'm not going to shoot you, like I'm a good boy. And there's this moment at the end where it's like, he knows that these people have committed war crimes and he's going to trust them to hand themselves back in. He's going to let them take their ship, which is a weapon, which is a piece of technology, to go back and get repaired and go back into the Clark fleet because no matter what, guys, we'll win in the end and you'll get tried later. I just think that's just one of those things where it's idealistic. Not from just Sheridan, but I think of JMS because we know that this doesn't come to bite him in the ass all that much.
No, it doesn't.
This is the difference between Battlestar Galactica and Babylon 5. Battlestar is way more cynical about this.
Oh, yes, it is.
And Babylon 5, for a show that can be labeled as very cynical and pessimistic, this is one of those aspects that I feel... about the Earth Civil War is JMS hopes for the best when it comes to this. Like, it really is, if we take out the bad guy, people will vote for the right thing because they now know that was bad. Now, I think there's some critiques that people make online or in the modern age, where it's easy to kind of give your thumbs down and take down some points on a show because of something like this. And I understand that. And that's why some shows like Battlestar Galactica were really popular when they came out, because it was so unflinchingly bleak and didn't compromise in that way. And I want to just give a side of defense against my own comments that I just made of the pure entertainment fist pump factor that you get of Mackie being on the good guy side and his first officer getting taken out by his own crew and the lady on Ken Jenkins' ship saying, get him off the deck. All of that, there is this cathartic thing that I as a viewer just can't get enough of. And I think on a writing level, JMS isn't afraid to write for the masses, write for the crowds, write for those moments that make us go, fuck yes. And some of those tricks when it comes to these type of stories have these type of moments and beats in it where they're there for that sake, but people online or people in reviews can critique that as like a failing, like I was just a moment ago, and I still stand by my comments, but I'm not going to brush over the fact that even though all of that stuff is there that I find to be a little bit annoying, honestly, I'm not going to lie to you and say that I didn't get extreme satisfaction out of the fact that some of Sheridan's placed optimism was right, and there are people who want to join the fight, and there are people out there who try to grab at power and lose. It is extremely satisfying to see. I wrote this as a point of discussion, and I think this is no longer relevant, but I did want to ask, is this as good as they say? This is one of the higher rated episodes. This is the title of the season. Is this as good as they say? This is also one that is brought up a lot from the fan base and people when talking about B5. No Surrender, No Retreat. That's one of the greats. That's a great episode. It's so important to the show. I put that there because I just watched the episode and I didn't feel as wowed by it as some of the others we've even had in this season or as well as previous, but having to talk about it right now is just giving me such a finer appreciation for it. But what do you think, Rachel? Is this as good as they say? Is this worthy of being the title of the season? Like, is this yes. as big of a hitter for you?
Yes. And yes, it clearly demonstrates the strength of this season. It highlights the theme, it follows through, it does all of the things. It's the heart of this season.
Hey, I don't like the idea any more than you do. But either we commit ourselves to this completely or we don't do it. Once we pull the first trigger, we can't hesitate to pull the next one, because they sure won't. Well, once we're in, we're in. No surrender, no retreat.
Let's talk about the actor who appeared in this episode. Let's turn on our spotlight, the section where we do talk about somebody who was in the episode. We go over their performance, their career, and any interesting facts we've learned about them. Ken Jenkins is the man to talk about, and he played Captain Hall in this. And I've done a bunch of the talking. I just want to know from you, I mean, we're both big Scrubs fans. You obviously saw Scrubs before B5. I just want to ask you straight up, is it distracting for you to see Dr. Kelso, Ken Jenkins, in this episode? Is it?
Yes.
Does it take away from what he's doing as an actor?
A little bit. Like, it gets less each time, because each time I watch it, I'm further away from Scrubs and I'm more familiar with the show and the episode and this character. So it gets less each time.
I've always forgotten that he was here until he shows up. I'm like, oh yeah, Dr. Kelso. But here's the truth of it. I don't care that he's Dr. Kelso in relation to Babylon 5. Whenever I watch the episode, I get angry at him because of the character he is. I love Dr. Kelso. He's my favorite character in Scrubs, okay? Laying that out there. So this is the highest of praise that Ken Jenkins in this episode plays one of the fucking most shitty, fucking annoying pieces of Earth Force garbage we've had in the show, where I just look past him being Dr. Kelso and see him as this mean mugging piece of shit that I hate. And when I say hate, I mean in the way that I'm supposed to. And I delight in his performance. I think he's a great actor. I really love him here. He was doing some amazing work. He played an antagonist who wasn't crazy and wasn't an idiot either. He played a guy who is clearly wrong, clearly on the bad guy's side, but I wouldn't say he played it as just evil man. He didn't just play it as bad guy. He didn't need a big scar on his face and be called Ari Benzane because he's insane. He didn't need an evil villain voice. All you need is Ken Jenkins, who's a little guy, just to just have that scowl on his face and that hoarse voice of his. And I never thought for a second that this guy wasn't a soldier. I thought, this guy's a fucking soldier, man. And so, to me, he gives a fantastic performance that I do think, like many like you, overlook because, I'm not saying you're overlooking, but it does get overlooked because he's known for being in a specific comedy show. But to me, I think he's one of the greatest Earth Force captain, like Earth Force villains we've had in the show. I think he's great. What did you think of his performance, though? Now that we've gone past your views on Scrubs interfering, what did you think about Ken Jenkins here?
Yeah, I thought it was really solid. You immediately get a feel for what the character is like. Like, we mentioned the physicality of certain actions that he takes and the way that he holds himself in the chair and the sort of degradation of his confidence as the battle goes on and the increase of the fear that we see in him until he's very upfront with what he's afraid of being court-martialed, because he knows that if Clark loses power,
he loses. He's a coward. He's a worm. Like, he's not even a Clark loyalist. He's selfish. Because when all of it goes down, he's not fighting to the bitter end because he believes what they're doing is right. He's fighting to the bitter end because he doesn't want to get in trouble. He doesn't want to let Sheridan do the right thing, because if Sheridan does the right thing, that means his ass is on the line. Like, he's the ultimate worm. But Ken Jenkins does it in such a way where you, like, almost look past how much of a pathetic person he is. Because when I just lay it out like that, you can imagine in your head, like, another actor playing this as so snivelly. But you wouldn't describe him as that, would you? Like, you would never use the word that he's a sniveling, self-serving man with the way that Ken Jenkins plays him. That is in there. Like, that's a part of the character, but I would never say, like, that's how he portrays the guy. He's just a piece of garbage, and I love him. Now, Scrubs, let's just talk about that first. I said it, he's my favorite character in Scrubs. I love that performance, his voice, his line deliveries. He is very good at doing the Leslie Nielsen thing almost, where he's this older gentleman who can come across as serious, but he is unafraid to be silly, unafraid to just make an absolute clown of himself. So many wacky costumes and silly scenarios that he gets himself into, but he plays it so straight-laced.
Yeah.
And he has some of my favorite lines, some of my favorite episodes of Scrubs, which is a series that I have very mixed feelings about, conflicted feelings about. he often has my favorite episodes. Like, whenever I mention Scrubs, the favorite episodes are always like, oh, the one where we find out that Dr. Kelso was a country star in his younger days and he sings all of these songs about his wife. Like, that's my favorite episode of Scrubs. That's my favorite episode. And it's about him. And another one that I really like, which is actually one written during the writer's strike where the writing team of Scrubs was no longer writing episodes of the show. My favorite episode is one of my favorites is in that season, which is not a well-liked opinion, but I like the one where Dr. Kelso reflects on who he was and he retires. Like, he says, you know what, I've lived this experience and I'm now coming to terms with it, that it's my time is done. One of the greatest episodes to me, written in a time where people often loathe the show. So I love him in Scrubs. What do you think, Rachel? Scrubs, that's a very important show to you. It's been one that we've often talked about in our private life as being a very seminal piece of business as we grew up. One that we both have conflicted feelings about. Well, when it comes to Ken Jenkins, tell me a bit about your thoughts on him in Scrubs, because that's what everyone knows him for. That's what you know him for.
Like, he's just solid. You always know what you're going to get when it comes to a Kelso scene, and you know that it's going to be funny. Like, even when it's, like, the shittier seasons, for the most part, he's still good. Even, like, they're like, oh, no. The people sent him away. We need him back. Like, the show's not as good without him.
He would just live in the cafeteria eating muffins. Like, what they do with his character is kind of embarrassing, but he is so funny. Like, the character in Ken Jenkins is so... When I was younger, you know this very well because you've seen it happen to me. I've talked about this on a Patreon when we talked about Stranger Things. I'll say, oh, I like this character, and people will react negatively and go, oh, of course you fucking like that character. When I was younger, I would say Dr. Kelso is my favorite, and I'd get that reaction of, oh, of course you like Dr. Kelso. Because the real answer is you should like Dr. Cox. Like, that was always, like, the correct answer of who's the best character in Scrubs? Dr. Cox. I always said Dr. Kelso, and I'd get that reaction of, oh, of course. Of course you like Dr. Kelso. And I think that's changed. I think everyone's kind of in agreement. Like, he is one of the top four characters. I think he usually goes Dr. Kelso, the janitor. Yeah. I mean, Dr. Cox, the janitor, Dr.
JD's
Kelso. Oh, JD's never in the top.
Everybody.
He's not even in the top 10. He's
far down.
Hiya, sport.
Your skin is wrinkly.
Yeah? Well, that shirt you're wearing is gay.
Are you familiar with Ken Jenkins outside of that? Have you seen him in anything? Have you really experienced him in much? Because
no, like, I was looking through and I'm like, oh, yeah, I know, I think I've heard of that thing, and oh, yeah, that, and I remember him from TNG.
Where he played a shitty doctor, an evil, crappy, egotistical doctor.
But I kept on being like, have I seen that? Or do I just know that?
So I was surprised by how much I have seen him in stuff. And I think this should be the topic of conversation, which is he's had a career change because of Scrubs. When you look at his work before Scrubs, very little to no comedy work in his resume. Very little, if any. A lot of authority figure roles, doctors, judges, cops, soldiers, things of that nature, right? Where he plays people who are gruff and in charge because he has that voice and he has that face. Even if he doesn't have that stature, but he has that look to him of somebody who's going to bark orders at you and dictate things. So you look at his career before Scrubs and it's made up of a lot of one-off roles, lots of little roles. And I've seen him in things like The X-Files. He's in The X-Files as a cop. Would you be surprised to hear that? He was in the Psycho remake as a cop. He was in The Stand, right? He's in stuff that I've seen. He was in Sliders. He was like a doctor in that as well. And I mean this sincerely, like I said before, when I see him in B5, I don't think of Dr. Kelso. I don't. And I think that's a part of what his life is before being Dr. Kelso is, I forget that it's the same actor when I look at the things I have seen him in, because it is drastically different. Because he isn't silly. He's straight. He's on point. Yes, he has that iconic voice that is very fun to do, but in all seriousness, he's a fantastic actor, and he is typecast a lot in the earlier days of his career, so they all kind of blend together. He will often play a shitty guy. He was rarely ever in ongoing shows. Before Scrubs, he did Wise Guy with Jonathan Banks.
Yeah.
He was only in like 15 episodes of that 70-episode long show. The other one that he did for ages was the Homefront, which I don't know too much about. But again, that was for a brief moment, like a little while.
He never seemed to get very steady roles. Even like he started out on the stage, he doesn't have that many credits when it comes to like Broadway productions. So it's just like he just keeps on sort of flitting about the place and picking up work where he can.
He's been in things, but in little roles like The Abyss. He was in The Abyss. He was in Clock Stoppers, if you remember that. But definitely, even after Scrubs, he seems to have retired from, at least stopped television and film acting in 2019, which I don't know if that means he stopped officially or, you know, the world and what we went through after 2019 means he's stopped, especially because he's older. He's 82, I do believe. But even after Scrubs, it's not like he went straight into doing nothing but comedies either. He still went back to what he used to do anyway, being the other big comedy thing he did of note, which I do remember, is Cougar Town, where he did a similar thing there where he's a goofy guy. You look at his IMDb picture, it's this ludicrous picture. It's from Cougar Town. And other than that, he appeared in the series of unfortunate events, but it wasn't like he was a silly, goofy role there. He was just a guy. I just don't know. I think Scrubs was like this weird outlet that no one had discovered before, which is this guy is very funny and we can do funny things with him. And then after that, I don't know if it was him by design or just the industry didn't continue to exploit that. It's just kind of been used a couple of times after that. And so Ken Jenkins lives in this really interesting world of entertainment for me, where I love him as Kelso, but when I look at him outside of that, he really does say to me, Dr. Kelso is like the outlier of his career, even though it's probably the defining role of his entire body of work. It actually seems like it doesn't line up with what he does in general, which I always find when that happens to actors to be truly fascinating to look at, and I often wonder what it's like for them.
So when I first went in to read for Bill Lawrence, the first shocking thing was that he was smiling, honestly smiling, and was very supportive. Laugh a little bit just to get you started. That's funny. That's funny. And lift you. And you would say, oh, it is? And you'd forget to be nervous.
I'm going to rate this episode, to nobody's surprise, on a scale of yum being bad and yum yum being good, I'm giving this a good, which is yum yum.
Yum yum. It's a yum yum from me. Yum yum.
I want to know what we will be talking about and watching next time on Babylon 5.
On the next Babylon 5.
The exercise of vital powers. We're going to change the world, Mr. Garibaldi. But is the ex-security chief willing to betray Sheridan to bring about that change?
Probably.
Franklin learns why Sheridan wants to revive the crypto-sleeping telepaths, which was acknowledged in this episode.
Funny, because that's actually a spoiler for that episode, because in the next episode we don't even find... I mean, I guess we kind of find that out. We find out that he's following up on what Sheridan asked him in this episode, but he has a telephone, he has a video call conversation that horrifies him to the core that does kind of point to what, hey, you know what, I'm going to say That's a little bit of a spoily thing, but whatever, it doesn't matter. What matters is you follow us on our social media of choice, whatever one you want to use or do use. You can find us on there under Yum Yum Pod or Yum Yum Podcast. We have a Patreon where you could pay us some of your money for some bonus exclusive content out there. We have so many things on there. We are talking about the Alien movie franchise. We give our thoughts on things ranging from the Orville, ranging from episodes of Star Trek, the best and worst rated ones. And we've talked about the seminal series. When I say seminal, to me, but in general, overlooked series, Space Above and Beyond. And currently, we're going through for the first ever time, watching for the first ever time, The Expanse. So come on over to the Patreon and you can get all of that right now. Hook it up into your veins and get the full Yum Yum treatment. Rachel, if people want to contact us directly, where can they do so?
Well, if they're signed up to the Patreon, they can just message us on the group Discord. But if you're not part of that, then I suppose you'll just have to message us on one of those socials. But The one that Ryan wanted me to say was you can email us at yumyumpod@gmail.com.
That is all. Please make sure to watch that in next episode for the next episode's discussion, as well as share us around to all your friends, enemies, lovers, haters. Jakar was too busy being a sook in this episode to
too
say
busy
it.
Drinking.
Yeah, he was getting his drink on to say he was too busy doing that to say the wonderful line. Ooh, would tap his chest and say, good evening to you.
Good evening to you, Ryan.
Oh, yes.
Ah, Mr. Kettleboy.